Welcome to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP, the federal leader in retirement planning seminars. Join NITP this morning for an hour of plain talk on planning your future. You've got questions, they've got answers.
Good morning and welcome to For Your Benefit. We're here this morning to talk. We're going to talk with Ellen McCarthy in just a bit. And Ellen is the president of the Intelligence and National Security Alliance, former Fed. And she's going to talk about the intelligence community and things going on there. She's been a guest for the last several years and a very good one. But right now, it's Tammy Flanagan and I, co-hosts of this show for your benefit. Tammy Flanagan, Senior Benefit Director, NITP, weekly GovExec columnist, and every time I get puzzled, which is often on benefits, that's my go-to person. Anyway, good morning, Tammy.
Good morning, Bob.
All right.
Good to be here.
Yeah, it's good to be here on a nice, crisp, cool day in D.C. for a while. And I'm Bob Lines. I'm an accountant finance type with NITP. And Ellen just came in.
Walked in. Sorry.
Well, it's fine. We just started on the air. Good morning, Ellen.
Good morning.
good to see you. Anyway,
it's good to be here.
We gave your title and where you work and the like. And I was saying to Tammy that you and I have done this by ourselves a few times before, right?
Right.
And we filled the whole hour up. Didn't we?
Just chatting.
Yeah. No, but I mean, it was very good. And I remember one year I asked you, who need not apply for an intelligence community job? And your answer was great. I won't repeat it, but it was good. So today, if we can kind of, you sent us up these talking points. Could we just kind of reverse it and then we get into this smart business and whatnot after? But you were talking about cyber education and INSA, Cyber Educational Task Force. All right, why do we have a task force? That's a silly question. And cyber education, who need apply there? Need not apply. So in other words, if you're looking for to farm the kids coming out of school and or somebody with some experience, what do you look for?
Well, believe it or not, we're looking for a wide variety of folks. Of course, we're looking for people with technical, mathematic, science skills, people who understand X's and O's and ones and zeros, you know, computer scientists. But we're also looking for just analysts, people who have critical thought skills, people who've been to law school, you know, people who can think critically, who are willing to focus on this very specific threat that this nation faces. And that is those who are trying to break into our computer networks, both in the private sector and in the public sector. It's a growing field. I mean, amidst all the budget cuts, especially in the defense side of the house, this is an area of great growth. And folks both in the private sector and the public sector are looking for skilled workers. Believe it or not, there's a lot of opportunities.
So it isn't just computer people. It isn't math people. It's I remember years ago somebody worked in a friend of mine went to work for the intelligence community, and I just thought to myself, what do you got to offer? They were smart and they were good people, but I have this vision. It's all computer stuff. And no, they weren't. They had a logical mind, and I guess it's like a chess game with math and with logic.
Right.
And I have no idea. You know, I watch the movies, and I'm baffled by the intelligence movies that
right.
you see. And that's probably true, but not A through Z.
Right.
Yeah. So, and now, are you finding it tougher to find people? Is it because they work for government contractors? Is it because they're not there? Is it because the schools are not producing? Or is it all of the above?
It's all of the above. In fact, one reason we put this task force together is to work with companies, especially who have folks who sort of have these skill sets and identify what is it that they want? What is it that they have? Let's identify specific proficiencies and let's take them back to the universities and say, these are the kind of students we want. What does it take to be a cyber analyst? And so we're putting those skill sets together and we're identifying them and then we're defining them and then we're passing them on to especially the local universities, saying these are the kind of kids and maybe not so kids. Kids are going back for a second career. This is what we need.
I think a lot of degrees in some of the universities also are kind of targeted towards specific jobs that are needed today, like the CSI jobs and right. intelligence community jobs. So I would think that maybe some of the schools are actually programming some of their coursework to meet those needs.
Right.
Is that happening?
No, it is. But, mm-hmm. You know, also it's just not a clearly defined field right now. Or you have universities that will have cyber programs. Mm-hmm. But is it really what the government and the
needs.
Private sector needs? So let's partner with them and figure out what it is precisely that we need. And that's the goal of this task force.
Okay. Now, this show, although we are in the Washington Beltway, it goes outside, and we can tell from the emails. It's just not local D.C., Baltimore, or Richmond area. We'll get them from the West Coast. We'll get them from outside the continental United mm-hmm. States. So as we're talking, people will hopefully, I know they'll be listening, but they might not be aware of that. Somebody potentially outside the Beltway, yeah, we need this. But, you know, this person, this friend of mine might have that. So the profile isn't necessarily a computer nerd, right?
No, of course, technical skills are highly desired right now, but not necessarily just technical skills. Critical thought skills are also very important. So, and absolutely, there's universities all over the country that the intelligence community works with. These universities are known as centers of academic excellence, and the intelligence community provides them with resources to help educate and train the kind of folks that the community wants to work with. And they're all over. So
you know both sides, though. You were with the feds for how long?
23 years.
You're not that old. I
met yes,
nobody, people on the other side.
Compared to what?
To me. But I could tell you, I met Ellen, what were you, 10?
Yeah.
Yeah. And actually, I have a few people to thank for being here, your father being one of them. I wouldn't
Me
be
too.
Here if it wasn't. and Tammy along the way, and Anne, and it's all women, and my wife. You know, I don't think I'd be sitting here if it wasn't for certainly your father. You know, Tammy, I don't
Surround
know if you
yourself
know,
with good people, right?
Her father was the one that got me into seminars. He was a tough cookie, but this is how he taught you.
Mm-hmm.
You would do your talk. And you do what you were to cover, and you'd look down, and I'd say, it's time for Mr. McCarthy to take over. And he would look up, and he says, yeah, you're doing okay. And he would walk out of the room. Gone. It was the best thing that ever happened, but at the time, I didn't get the message. But after it was over, I said, this isn't so bad. And he says, yeah, you're doing okay, going up to New York by yourself. And we used to travel the country. Anyway.
Best way to learn by fire.
And exactly. He was right on target with it. A lot of things. Anyway, let's get back to this. So 23 years. Mm-hmm. So you know that side.
What agency were you with?
I started with the Office of Naval Intelligence, and then I moved down to work for the Naval Sinclair Fleet, mm-hmm. Commander-in-Chief Atlantic Fleet, and then I worked for the Coast Guard for a few years, and then I worked for... My resume, the Undersecretary mm-hmm. of Defense for Intelligence. So
you've moved quite around. But a lot of it related to the intelligence field, which is what got you into this as a post. Did you retire under one of the early outs? Were you affected by the downsizing?
I didn't retire. Mm-hmm. I actually, you know, one of the benefits of the FERS program is that you can make
it's much
moves.
More portable.
Mm-hmm. And I would like to go back someday. So yeah. That's...
Well, that is a nice thing because you took your TSP with you and now you probably contribute to some type of 401k.
Right.
Your Social
right.
Security follows you throughout life. So moving around under the FERS program is certainly a lot easier than trying to do something like that under CSRS, like what I was under when I left. I basically lost those 8 years where your service right. just continues. And if you do return, you'll just add on to what you had.
Right. And I have to tell you that in terms of the intelligence community, I think many of the agencies are taking advantage, or at least their personnel are taking advantage of FERS from that perspective. And as a result, you're getting a far more diverse and I think a better prepared mm-hmm. community. I have to say that leaving the government for the last 4 years was the best thing I've ever done
really
in terms of gaining a perspective on how things work on the outside.
That's true.
What got you into the government? What attracted you to go in?
You know, I think it was... Well, first of all, I always liked intelligence. I'm nosy, so that was always something that I found very intriguing. And really, it was a person. It was somebody who talked to me and said, hey, have you thought about this? I was working for a small newspaper in Annapolis, Maryland, and the publisher, actually, his name was Phil Merrill, said, hey, have you thought about this? And I really hadn't. And as a result of his mentorship, I was able to, you know, make the decision to come in. But
right. You think about government work, and that doesn't really tell you what all that means. And there's so many different opportunities for students coming out of school to move into federal service and find jobs that are very rewarding and also very valuable to our country. So that's just one example of how that can work.
Here I am 23 years later saying I'd like to go back. It's not a bad thing.
So are there any special benefits to working in the intelligence community that the other ones might not have? Is there a faster track to grade increases? Is there, I won't say better learning opportunities because the feds are second to none with regards to training and the like, but is there a fast track? Is there... I can't say. Anyway, there's some people that get certain benefits that other ones don't.
Well, most of the intelligence community agencies, not all of them, because most of the agencies in the intelligence community actually fall under other departments. So they mm-hmm. tend to work with those departments' personnel authorities. Most of them, with only a couple of exceptions, are in the accepted service, which means that they can directly hire people, unlike the other agencies who have to follow more of the civil service, the Title V processes and authorities. Mm-hmm. So it's in some ways it's easier to get a job in the intelligence community because you can be hired directly.
But then you have to pass the security clearance.
There's a good thing. There's a good side and a bad side to this. And one is the security clearance process is pretty invasive. So, mm-hmm. You will almost certainly have to have a polygraph. You'll have a very in-depth investigation of your personal life over 10 years or more. You're subject to drug testing. So it is, when you go in, you're going in with the knowledge that your life is an open book. But that said, being in the accepted service does have some benefits. I mean, you can, to your point, there is a lot more opportunities for promotion, for recognition of performance. I think it's much better than really outside the accepted service mm-hmm. under Title V. Another downside to it, however, is that finding a job within the intelligence community is not always the easiest thing. There are ads on USA Jobs, just like all the other agencies, but they tend to be open ads, and I'm not sure they're very useful in terms of, and I'm probably going to get in a lot of trouble for saying this, but I mean, I don't think that it's the best way to get a job in the community. It really is about knowing people, and
agencies do recruiting at college fairs and things like that, where they would then be able to talk to students who are coming out of school who are looking for that type of work?
There's a lot of recruiting that goes on at the university level, and there's job fairs around the country. And so that's certainly one way. But the best way really is, if you're a student or somebody who's interested in getting a job in the community, is to take classes that are involved in intelligence, get involved in associations,
to meet
people. Mm-hmm. And it really is, if your neighbor is working, you get to know your neighbor.
Now, your organization wouldn't be open to that type of thing. Like, students wouldn't be looking to join.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. We have, not only do we have students who are members, but we have quite a few interns.
I was going to say, maybe you help them find internships to get them started in that career path.
We have a very robust intern program, and all of our interns ultimately get positions in the community, which is how, one reason they join INSA, and it's one way we reimburse them for their mm-hmm. time at INSA. And it's a good thing for INSA, because then we get young folks who are going into the community, either the private sector or the public sector, who now know INSA and represent our programs to their coworkers. And
what is the website again?
It's www.insaonline.org.
That's INSA.
INSA.
Which stands for Intelligence Something, right?
And National Security Alliance.
There you go.
Online.org.
Okay, now for those of you tuning in late, we're talking with Ellen McCarthy, the president of INSA, Intelligence and National Security Alliance, and Tammy Flanagan, and me, Bob Lines. But Tammy and Ellen could probably play tennis here, and I'll just watch the match. So you have these opportunities then for people. You're going to mentor and then pass them along to your favorite agencies.
Yeah, or private sector companies who work with the community. So
now, how do you find these kids or people?
Well, there's a couple of ways we find them. We recruit just like the community within universities. We were very much just with local universities, but we've expanded our outreach to colleges, mostly up and down the East Coast, working with their the folks within each university who are involved in career mentoring and that kind of thing. A lot of it is word of mouth through our members, through folks who work with INSA, through the community, and the word is getting out that it's a good opportunity for younger people.
Do you place them in agencies, or do they work directly with INSA?
They work directly with INSA, and we don't place them in agencies directly, but our task forces and councils are made up of folks from government and the private sector. And so by working with these task forces and councils on products, whether they're papers or they're, you know, their meetings, they get to meet a lot of people
get a good overview of different types of work rather than just kind of pigeonholed into one thing that they might not really be their main interest.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. But it really is all about relationships. And so they'll develop a very professional relationship with some very senior people in the community. And as a result, they've got a leg up in terms of getting a job when they graduate. Another way that we offer young people and not so young people an opportunity to get a glimpse into the community is through our Intelligence Champions program, which we host on a quarterly basis. In fact, we have one coming up in September, September 5th. And we typically bring in a boy and a girl from the community. In this case, we have John Pistol, who's the director of the Transportation Security Agency, TSA. And then we have a woman named Lynn Dougal, who works in the Homeland Security sector of Deloitte, which is one of our member companies. And they'll come in and talk a little bit about sort of their experiences, how they got to where they did, you know, managing family and everything else. And then at these events, you know, not only do you get to talk to them, but you get to talk to other seniors who come to these kind of events. They're very, you know, they're very sort of casual, really an opportunity to engage with a mm-hmm. lot of folks at a pretty senior level. And so that's
a good way to reach out.
Yeah.
We did a conference once, military controllers. Now, these are the financial controllers. And all the big dogs were there, including us. But we're very small relative to the rest. And there was a lot of intelligence community type software companies. But Deloitte was there. What's the other one? The Arthur Anderson.
Accenture.
Yeah, they were there. And
Pricewaterhouse.
Yeah, so, you know, I'd walk around and talk. And, you know, you could talk only so far, and then you weren't going any further. But that was a huge, it was 3,500 people.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, we're not that big. We don't want it to be that big. We try and keep it to about 100 people. That's big enough.
Sure.
Yeah.
Now, the other thing that seems to be in the news lately, and I even heard Tom Temin talking about it this morning, is this new law that passed. It's dealing with sequestration. And I noticed that's one of your talking points as well, that's going to affect the ability for intelligence communities to do the work that they do, given that their budgets might be cut significantly. Did you want to speak to that?
Yeah, I would love to speak to that.
Somehow we knew.
Number one on my talking point.
And maybe like start off with just what does this really mean, this sequestration? Because that's a word that's kind of thrown out there. Does it really just mean budget cut? That's just a nicer way to say it, or maybe a tougher way to say it?
Yeah, this was actually a law that was passed a couple of years ago. Actually, it was during the Bush administration. And it was all about taking cuts to the budget. And I think the thought was at the time was that Congress and the executive branch would be able to figure this out. But they haven't been able to figure it out. And ultimately, the cuts are supposed to go into effect in January of 2013. And the Department of Defense is going to be the primary taker of these hits at this point. Again, I think the spirit of the law was that there would be some sort of fair share across government. But that's not where we are right now, certainly not with the last couple of Congresses. And so unless something happens, effective January 2013, you're going to have about $1 trillion that is going to get cut from the DOD budget over the course of the next 5 years. And sort of where we are right now is that there's the executive branch has said, you know, we don't believe this is going to happen. Congress, this is your job to figure this out. And I think Congress is actively engaged in trying to figure it out. But if they don't, it's going to start. It's going to happen. And you're already starting to see the impact of this potential hit in terms of the private sector side or they have a requirement to actually notify their workforce 90 days in advance of potential layoffs. And
so they could cut back on some government contracting jobs.
Huge cuts. In fact, Lockheed Martin already sent out notices to all of its workforce that effective late October, early November, they could be laying off as many as, you know, thousands of people. And the other, some, especially in the aerospace industry, they're a little nervous about this. And on the executive branch side, there just hasn't been I think that certainly the Department of Defense has already been sort of trying to schedule a drawdown of forces, especially with the with troops coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan. And so they've really been working to take some significant cuts on their own. And then when you add another $1 trillion on top in January, it's not going to be pretty. It's going to be kind of messy. And so the impact on the intelligence community could be pretty significant in terms of its ability to do its job.
They're not protected from these cuts then?
No, they're not protected. And most of the intelligence community actually falls under the Department of Defense. So, you're going to see some you know, major layoffs.
When it boils down to the individual employee working for the government, could they also be impacted by furloughs or maybe further downsizing, buyouts? Maybe not buyouts. The agencies won't have the money to pay the buyouts.
It will happen. Yeah. I mean, there will be layoffs. I'm not just saying this because it's scary. It'll happen. There's no other way to do it. And unfortunately, the Director of National Intelligence, who's the lead for the community, has been saying for the last couple of years he recognizes that the budget is too big, and they've been trying to draw down the budget. They actually haven't been trying. They've been doing a great job, but not at the expense of manpower or research and development. Mm-hmm. Under this scenario, everything's going to get hit, and it'll be in salami slices. It won't be pretty. And not only does it have a short-term impact, but it'll have a long-term impact on the community's ability to get the right people to do the things that they need to do. So,
what's INSA doing to try to understand that or maybe make some impact on it, if anything?
We have a couple of groups that have been working with, actually, the government to look at how does the private sector manage during
tough times.
And there have been some tough times over the last 5 years. So what are the tools that the private sector uses to manage its workforce? And this is actually an area where I think more government people should come out to the private sector and see how it works and then take some of those lessons learned back. As much as I love the government, its ability to manage itself sometimes is you know, like any big bureaucracy, it can be challenging.
Yeah, because you're on a grand scale of employees and personnel and everything, budget.
You're in a not-for-profit mode. You have a large workforce. Mm-hmm. The way you incentivize people is different in the government than it is in the private sector. And so it's challenging, and you sort of fall into this is the way it's always been done kind of mentality, which is not always good.
Is there duplication of efforts that you would, just looking overall, where one agency kind of does what the other agency does, but they're more aligned to this branch of the service, or they're more aligned to no branch of the service, and they're doing the same thing? I'm not telling you it's any different in an accounting firm or a seminar firm. We try to minimize it, but it just happens. But I can't imagine running the government. So, I mean, if you see that would be one of the ways that you would.
Yeah, I mean, I think the government has to ask itself, or certainly the intelligence community has to ask itself, what is it that we're supposed to be doing and what is it that we can no longer do? And that's a tough question when you have 18 agencies who all think what they're doing is very, very, very important. It's also a very risky sort of management scenario, because if you make a mistake... It's not like in the private sector where you make a mistake, you hire more people or you invest more in this area. Or you go broke, you go out of business.
Make a mistake, people's lives are at risk.
Lives are at risk. Mm-hmm. And so you've got to sort of identify what level of risk are you going to take? What do you really need to do and what don't you need to do? And duplication of effort in the intelligence community is not such a bad thing.
If you want it.
Oh, thank you. Sometimes it's good to have a couple of set of eyes on one problem, weapons of mass destruction somewhere. as an example, it's good to have more than one group of people looking at it. So these are some of the tough questions the community has to deal with. And there's not going to be a lot of time if January 2013, let's cut $1 trillion. So it's a little scary. And INSA is trying to help by at least bringing in some very smart people in the private sector who've spent some time in senior positions in the public sector to say, hey, government, this is what you need to think about. And that's our Smart Change Task Force. They put out a paper a year ago, and we're in the process of having another paper come out in October. This one is going to focus exclusively on manpower, because that's the area that we'll see the biggest.
You can read that paper on your website as well. So
the first paper is on our website, and the second paper we're going to be rolling out in October or November.
As a result of the discussions happening now.
Right. Well, it's interesting. It wasn't just sequestration that prompted us to write this paper. It was actually a follow-on to the first paper that we wrote 18 months ago, where we saw that the community was facing some significant budget
challenges.
Mm-hmm. And so on top of those budget challenges, sequestration now gets dropped. And so I think the papers are very timely. And we've done this working with the government sector. So
For those of you all listening, you probably have questions of Ellen, but you may not be able to ask on air. But it's 202-465-3080, 202-465-3080. It's a little past 10:30. It's August 13th, 2012. Don't call us after about another 20 minutes because we won't be here, but you can email us. And take this email down in case you have the questions, as well as Ellen's website, but we'll do that in a minute. So the email address is benefit, as in benefit, at nitpinc.com. For your benefit, at nitpinc.com. Somebody says, what's NITP? It's the name of the seminar company that provide pre-retirement, mid-career, and beginning career, the radio show, Tammy's GovExec article, and the like. And the INC is because it's incorporated. Anyway, so please feel free to email us. Tammy gets all the emails and then distributes them, but she usually answers a good part along with
John. If they're related to benefits, if they're related to tax, they go to you.
Okay.
And if they're related to intelligence, Ellen's going to get them. Ellen, this term SMART, or I guess it's an acronym, is what's used a lot, and I see you use it here as well. Can you explain like how that SMART tool idea would help like solve some of these issues or maybe face some of these challenges? And what does that really mean? Because I know we throw that around, but what is it really getting to?
Well, I have to be honest with you. I think we picked it because it is one that resonates, mm-hmm. especially on the private sector side. SMART change is
right.
It's not a new concept. It really is. How do we make decisions? What is the process we go through?
But does it stand for something?
It's not an acronym. No, I don't. I should look it up. I think we just said SMART is in. Let's do something smartly.
Because Tammy and I were talking, we couldn't figure it out.
Well, maybe I should figure out what it's come up with some cool. Make it an acronym. But
I think at one time it wasn't. It first was rolled out. It stood for something.
Yeah,
I'm not sure
what it was.
But I do hear it a lot. Yes.
I think the impetus for this paper was that the budgets are going to get cut. At the time, we thought we were going to see up to 20% cuts in the Intel budget. This was a couple of years ago. Of course, that didn't happen. But you had a lot of very smart people who are now in the private sector who said, hey, when we were there, when there was a flat or reduced budget back in the 90s, just after the peace dividend, so the Soviet Union fell, and the perception was in the senior levels of government, well, now we don't have to worry about them, so let's make some significant cuts to the intelligence community. And what happened was they took salami slices, much like we may face here in January. And that had a huge impact on the community's ability to do its job, which we didn't see until 20 years later when 9/11 happened. Of course, the question was, why did 9/11 mm-hmm. happen? And we just didn't have the capabilities that we needed
in place due to some of the cuts that had
due to the cuts that had happened 20 years mm-hmm. earlier.
Mm-hmm.
So we brought in some of the senior leadership from the 1990s. Actually, Joan Dempsey was the woman who led this task force, and she was a senior manager in the community in the 1990s. She worked at CIA managing the community management staff. And we brought her and a bunch of other folks to say, if you had to do it all over again, would you have done this? Or would you have done it differently? And they were it was a very interesting discussion where they mm-hmm. said, we would have done it differently, and this is how we would have done it.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, now they were supported by the experience they'd gained out in the private sector working in companies. And so, and almost all of them, agency directors had said, I wish I had spent time, working at CACI or working at just name your company, and now I could go back and do it all over again because right. now I get it.
From the outside in gives you a different perspective.
Well, again, mm-hmm. I think there is some benefit to mm-hmm. having to run your own business or run your own company or work in a for-profit kind of mode and then come back
to this.
Do you all ever share ideas with the private sector and the public sector? I mean, the public sector probably doesn't want to hear how to do things, but if they saw the other side, there'd be a better appreciation. My world is the IRS. I think I understand how they work, and I understand actually they're more human than what I thought they were 40 years ago. They have a job to do.
Right.
And now, you know, you can sit and talk to them.
Well, I'll tell you, Bob, that's the exact reason INSA exists. I mean, it's been around for 30 years, but we're really here to be sort of that group, the forum where the public and private sector can sit down and look at something from their own optics. And I think it's been a very successful partnership. Because it really, you know, when you're in IRS, you see it from one perspective, but when you get out, you see it completely differently. And I think that's certainly the case in the intelligence community. These folks are doing their day-to-day jobs, and they are focused on their little problem. And as a result, they're not thinking about, you know, trillion-dollar budget, or they are thinking about it, but the way in which they might handle it would be a little different than maybe if they were now working at a company that is, you know, potentially is going to go out of business
because
they don't have enough revenue. So really getting those two perspectives together is really quite valuable. And yes, they don't always want to hear from us, I'll tell you, but we don't, we tend not to be a critical sort of body. We really aren't here saying you're not doing your job. You'll never see a paper or product that says you're not doing your job, because we've all been doing their job and they're doing a fantastic job. It's more, you know, here's some other ideas. Have you thought about this?
About.
It's more as a resource. We don't lobby. We're really here to be a resource. Mm-hmm. And I think we do a pretty good job of it. And so in this case, if you're running a business line in a company and you're going to go out of business if you don't bring in the best people and let go of those folks who are not necessarily the best people and, you know, invest in the right technologies, that's a resource.
You got to get the right people in the right positions.
Right. You need to work with your government partners to help them make those decisions right now. They also don't have the same tools that you have in the private sector in terms of authorities and processes in place to shape their workforce. I think we spoke about this in previous shows, but pay for performance is not something that exists across much of the community right now. They'll have strong performance management system, but they don't really have a pay-for-performance system.
No, and what we did have sort of failed, so
we have failed. Pay-for-performance systems, but I mean, they don't have that, so it's very hard for them to shape their workforce. Certainly, in a manner that is
meaningful
bad.
To the employees, that
right.
really gives them the incentive to do the work that needs to get done.
Right.
When we lecture to certain agencies. To me, it's a whole different group than it is versus outside most of the other ones. They're generally very serious. They're piercing with their questions, but they're a lot more animated than I would think. You know, initially when I first went there, they were kind of quiet, and now they're. But their questions are, you know, kind of to the point. Now I deal with a technical subject, and certainly they do as well. And it's a nice dialogue. That I find with them. And Tammy pretty much goes to the same place as I do, and even then some.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah, the agencies that are out there, I think the employees who work for the agencies have a lot of pride in the work that they do. And I think they, as much as like working in a private sector, that's the bottom line that gives you the incentive. But in the government, it's the mission of the agency that gives you the incentive, knowing that you're making a difference. So I think if agencies can give employees more of a role in defining that mission, then you feel like you're making a difference. I think it's important for federal employees to feel like they make a difference in the mission.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And I think that's where the pay-for-performance system sort of didn't hit the mark.
Because
most folks in the government are not working for, money is not their primary mm-hmm. motivator.
No.
And so but that said, a pay-for-performance system gives managers the flexibility to be able to make the hard decisions. And,
sure.
And that's...
Money is a motivator.
Right. And that's not necessarily what we have.
By the way, Ellen, how many years at the FBI, Tammy?
8. In the intelligence part. I meet a lot of people today that are in the intelligence community, and there is that relationship now with the FBI and with other law enforcement agencies and agencies that kind of deal directly.
FBI's in the intelligence community now. So
well, yeah, in that respect, they are. Yeah,
well, they
aside
have, no,
from
they,
the law
they,
enforcement
they're,
role.
They, they are a member, and they do now have a pretty significant intelligence capability. So,
when the Thrift had that one computer breach, it fell under the FBI, which I found surprising because I don't know any better. And
right.
FBI, but yeah,
it's not all about gangsters and kidnappers anymore.
No, cyber is a big area for FBI.
Cybersecurity is one of their, I think it's one of their top 10.
Right.
We always used to have the top 10 list of things, not just the top 10 wanted people, but the top 10 list of priorities. And I'm sure that's now at the top of the list.
Right. Well, to your point about perspective, we actually are running a task force right now called the Rebalance Task Force. And it's being led by some prior agency heads, Steve Cambone, General Hayden, who was the director of NSA, deputy director of CIA. And the question they're looking at is, given that we're moving out of Iraq and Afghanistan and we're bringing all these resources back to the United States, what is the policymakers' expectations going to be of the community? What's next? What is the next big thing to worry about? Mm-hmm. And what are you going to do, intelligence community? And it's very interesting, as we talk to all the agency heads, they've got it. You know, they said, we're working this. But for those folks who've left the intelligence community, they have a far different perspective. Not that they don't think the community has it, but more they look at it differently. Mm-hmm. And I think it comes from just getting the strategic pause and being able to look back and see what you could do and what you can't do. And
yeah, you gave some specific ideas of things that can be done to provide that kind of help. And maybe you could elaborate on a couple of those, because I think they're very important, but I don't really, not being from that area, I'm not really sure I could ask you an intelligent question about them, but they seem pretty innovative.
So one of the first points we made was, if you looked at sort of what you did in the past when the budget was flat, and really that's what we're talking about, is a flat budget. I think that's actually a common misconception that there are always going to be hits to the budget, but it's hits to planned increases. Mm-hmm. So really what you're telling the community is, are you going to be, how can you operate in a flat budget, which they should be able to. But given that scenario, ask yourself some questions. What can you stop doing and what can we do? And that's really, really hard to answer
really
a question. What can you stop doing? And it gets to just the culture of an organization.
Right. It gets you to admit that maybe some of the things we're doing aren't necessary.
Right.
And that's hard to say that, because everything we do serves a purpose,
right.
we feel.
Right. Absolutely.
That's admitting, admitting a problem.
I do remember when I was working mostly at the fleet level for the Navy, we would actually stop sending out messages just to see if anybody noticed that they weren't being read. And if we didn't hear anything back, we figured, okay, that's not needed anymore. But really, you've got to ask yourself these very hard questions. Mm-hmm. And what is it that we can do? And for the intel community, that's tough, because pretty much when the intel community is asked to do something, they do it. You know, they'll do it no matter what the resources are. But I mean, some of these senior, the DNI and the directors of all the agencies need to have this discussion, and I'm fairly certain they are.
Mm-hmm. I like the one about the Washington Monument that got my attention.
Well, that is true about when you're shaping your workforce. Mm-hmm. You know, especially at the middle management level. That's where you really need to take the hardest look. I think we tend to want to take the last in as the first out, you know, in terms of furloughs. And that's probably not the way to do it. Usually your middle management level is you know, it tends to be a large.
If you make a shift there, it's going to shift the whole bottom half of that workforce.
Right. And and to my point about the Washington Monument strategy, you know, if you're closest to D.C., you get to stay. That's sort of it's sort of also like the closest to D.C. also is the highest pay grade. So that's something else to consider.
You get
10 miles outside the Beltway, and the pay grade structure is much lower than it is inside Washington.
Even for your community?
Oh,
really?
We pretty much represent the government, overall government,
really?
In terms of grade structure and demographics. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I noticed that with DOD. When I travel the country and go to different Army bases or military bases, and the employees, you know, they'll comment on my examples where I use an employee who's earning $65,000 a year, and they're like, well, who makes that kind of money? I'm like, oh, I better take a step back and realize that, you know, the average federal salary may not be the same as the average D.C. federal salary.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. There is. I do think, though, that at least the intel community has looked at sort of the compensation data. And I will say that the D.C. community does reflect the private sector side. There really mm-hmm. is not much, with very few exceptions, largely DC compensation is similar to DC compensation in the private sector.
That could be a whole other discussion.
In general, people in DC just get paid better than those, you know, 20 miles outside.
Well, you figure at a headquarters level is where we normally are here in DC. So you have maybe more responsibilities of overall programs rather than just doing the work of that program. So that could be part of the reason.
Right.
Would these changes, if they come full force or half force, then somebody's saying, gee, I'd like to join the federal government, but why would I want to do it? Because in 6 months, they're going to let me go. What do we say to those people?
Well, I'll tell you, I think the community has made it, the DNI and his counterparts across all the agencies have said, we don't want to do what we did in the 90s. We don't want to stop hiring. We don't want to freeze hiring at the expense of future capabilities. So I think they have done a tremendous job, certainly over the last couple of years, to maintain hiring, even in tough fiscal times. Of course, with sequestration, I'm not sure if that's going to continue to be the pace. But certainly, you know, up until today, the agencies are still hiring. So,
The one thing when I go into agencies and they're experiencing downsizing in various areas, and maybe there's going to be more of that in the future if this happens, but I'll ask the employees, I'll say, well, if the agency was going to offer you a buyout to leave, I said, what is that amount? Just to see if they know. And I said, well, it's like a half a million or what? And they're like, no, not a half a million. They only offer us $25,000. I'm like, $25,000? I said, after taxes, that's only about $16,000 or $17,000. I said, is that enough to get you to go? And they all look at each other like, well, no, I wouldn't go for $25,000. But I think the reality is the reason why that does work is because we're so top heavy in the government right now. We have so many employees who are eligible to retire. In fact, if you took into account people eligible for early retirement, that's about half the workforce could retire if they really needed to. And so I think the $25,000 incentive is just enough to get someone who is planning on it anyway to say, okay, I guess I'll go.
Right.
And then they retire. But downsizing and right-sizing, yeah, as we've been doing since the 90s, hasn't been that difficult because of that. I think we have so many senior-level employees or experienced employees, but those are the ones we probably don't want to leave.
Well, certainly not yet. On the intel side, I had mentioned the salami cutting of the 1990s. Mm-hmm. And so what happened was there was this bathtub that was created, essentially. I don't know if that's something that's described.
Bathtub salami cutting.
Bathtub. So you created the bathtub.
You can tell she went into private sector. Yeah. the government doesn't use those terms now.
We stole them. But so you lost this whole segment of your workforce that really understood how to do the business of intelligence. And so there's some benefit to keeping these senior folks around now, so the junior people who started during the 9/11 time frame can, you know, get
take
some
over.
Experience, can
right.
take over, and that's mm-hmm. that's probably going to be about another 10 years
before that happens.
Yeah. So,
do the people in the government intelligence community side work more hours than what you normally would in a government job?
Where you might think they would be irregular hours at times, yeah. I would think.
I think it's yes to all of that. I've never worked outside the intelligence community, so I'm not
to compare.
But I will tell you that I think I certainly, in all the agencies I've worked in, I mean, you have a highly motivated workforce who puts in a lot of hours.
I think what's changed over the years, too, is with this age of technology, we tend to take our work with us wherever we go. We're always on the BlackBerry or on the computer or on some type of connection to our work, even when we're supposed to be relaxing.
And that's actually a challenge, though, on the intel side, because so much of the work is in the classified sector. So you're not working at home on you're staying at your job.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that at least in my experience, and even up until today, folks are not, they don't have the lazy government worker sort of.
Not that I've seen.
I haven't seen that anywhere.
You know, I notice most of the places that we would go during the week, you can't see a parking lot. I mean, the buildings are not visual from the highway, except for one major one, the Pentagon.
Right.
So I'll drive by the Pentagon if I'm, you know, downtown having dinner with somebody in Crystal City. And there's a bunch of cars there.
Right.
You know, it's Saturday night. And I go, you know, I was impressed. Other people would say, what? But
yeah, they're there 24/7. That's
yeah. And the other ones you couldn't see if you had to. You're not getting that close to the parking lot.
But no, I think it's a highly motivated, and it remains a highly motivated workforce. And I think that's where the community has done a good job of making sure that people understand why you're important, why you're supporting the mission. So,
you know, if somebody wanted to get involved with INSA, what would be the way that they would contact you or find out more about what you do? Go to our website,
send us a note. I think that, you know, we have task forces and councils. We're always looking for people. We have events coming up. We're always, I mentioned the mentoring event, the IC Champions event in September. We have...
Can you attend those events if you're not an INSA member?
Absolutely. In fact, we want to increase diversity, especially at the IC Champions events. So this is a great opportunity to get a glimpse of what the community's doing and get to meet some people. And
So if you have somebody, maybe one of our listeners might have a child or a grandchild who's in school right now, and this is something that they're interested in, so they could come to that type of event to help them understand what they're getting into.
And the next one with John Pistol and Lynn Dougal will be
a
lot of fun.
Very interesting.
We're very grateful that John's agreed to come because, you know, he can't get anywhere without getting questions about, you know, I went through security and they took my shoes. Why are they taking my shoes? And he's always very gracious.
And he's going to get to give his personal side of his story.
John was his career FBI, very senior at FBI, and raised a family and is just a great guy. So.
And these meetings and in the job fairs you go to, does anybody ever come up to you and say, okay, what benefits would I be entitled to if I joined the intelligence community versus if I didn't? Do you ever? I mean, that's our, that's Tammy's.
You know, I'll tell you, don't get a lot of those questions because, again, I think people in general who are coming to the government are not, I mean, at least in my experience on the intel side, they're not coming for the benefits necessarily. Mm-hmm. I'll tell you where we get the question most is when you get to the senior levels. So up until grade 15, the system, the process is very similar. Processes are very similar to the rest of government. But when you make it to the SES level, there is some difference in terms of how SESs are selected and how senior intel personnel are selected. We don't really have SESs. We'll have defense intelligence SESs or we'll have CIA SESs. And they operate under different authorities and the process is a little different. And it makes it a little more difficult for senior executives in the intelligence community to make the leap over to the rest of government because of that. Mm-hmm. It's not as so. If I was an SES at CIA and I wanted to go work at Department of Agriculture, it's not an easy transfer, right. And that's where we'll get most of the questions. Why? Why is it?
Why
not?
Can't we transfer our skills?
Yeah. And part of it is that the SES process in the intel side does not work through the OPM structure. So you don't necessarily send your package over to OPM where they have to certify it and say that yes, you are an SES, and that's really the big sticking point. So
do you ever bring people into SES from the consulting firms or the private sector?
Sure, if they meet the requirements. But if you're a defense intelligence SES, that's different from, say, a regular government SES type.
Right.
So that's where we'll get the most questions.
Interesting. Yeah, I've learned a lot.
Yeah. And you've counseled them. We're talking global. I remember one in particular. We'll talk about it off the air. You'll remember. Anyway, so where are we? We got 4 minutes. So as we bring this down, 4 minutes, right, Andrew? All right, Andrew says yes. All right, so bringing it down to a slow landing. How do we want to wrap all this up? I mean, use these neat acronyms. And if you had a message to the people that would consider a career or consider switching from an agency that wasn't to an agency that is intelligence, where do they go? I mean, they go to the agency, but...
Well, I suggest you come to an INSA event.
Well, somehow I knew you were going to say that, so...
I mean, we have... I mentioned it really is about getting to know people. And so if you were in the private sector looking to make a change, to come into the community, I would highly encourage you to take advantage of organizations like INSA as a means to start getting your feet wet and getting to meet the people that you need to meet to get in.
Yep. When I go on your website, although we've known each other a long time and we're good friends, it's very friendly, the pictures of your meetings and you addressing the crowd or the crowd talking to one another and go, it looks like kind of a cordial
group. A welcoming place
to
go.
Yeah.
I think that's, I mean, I'm glad that's what the optic that's that you're getting because that's really, we are. I mean, that's, we are, we're a forum. We're a place to sit down and chat. We don't, you know, it's interesting. Our members are both private sector and public sector. And so we may have company reps who are, you know, bitter competitors when they're working in the private sector. But when they come to INSA and they sit down or they chat, they're really now people who are interested in the business of intelligence, and they sort of leave that they're operating in their personal capacity. And so they may be competing on a contract, you know, at work, but when they come to us, they're talking about the future of commercial imagery or how is open source being, you know, is the intelligence community using open source to the level that it should be? I mean, they really are people who are passionate about the business of national security and intelligence, or they're interested in it. And so it really is, we really try to be a place that's open.
Could you also be a resource for people who might be out of work? Maybe someone who was laid off, someone who was downsized and is having trouble to get back into the workforce.
I think we're a tremendous resource for that. Mm-hmm. And that's why I would encourage you to come to our events. We have another one coming on in September, which actually gets to your first question about cyber. Mm-hmm. And it's the Cyber Innovation Symposium. In September, and that'll be a great opportunity to understand the business of cyber, how the community plays in the cyber world, and a great way to meet some folks and learn about what's going on in this sector. And that's certainly open to the...
And your website again?
It's INSA Online, INSAonline.org.
Okay, Tammy, please don't go to that meeting.
Don't go. Don't worry. I don't think they'd want me. All I know about is retirement. I'm trying to learn desperately about other things, but I'm kind of focused. I do one thing. Do it well, I hope.
Yeah, I think you do. Yeah. So, well, that's great. Tammy, final thoughts?
I just think keep on learning and look for opportunities. I think this is a wonderful opportunity for employees who are either trying to change career paths or people who are outside of federal service looking to get in. I think this lends itself to some great opportunities.
Yeah, and I enjoy all the shows, but I particularly like this one as well because it's not necessarily the people we deal with every day and we're there, but the insight as to how it works. And sounds like it's very sharing, happy. And it's usually a happy group wherever we go. You know how you can tell a happy group? I'll do this real fast. It happened this week. Agency will remain nameless. It was deafening walking in there. The seminar hadn't started. There were only 25 people in the room. And I said to the person, I said, this is unique because that's a happy group if they're talking to each other. You walk into a room and they're not talking to each other.
Yeah.
They're generally not happy.
It's an indication of morale. That's right.
Anyway, that's it. Andrew's saying, get off the air, Bob. Anyway, thanks, Andrew. Thanks, Ellen. Thanks, Tammy. And we'll be back next week. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
You've been listening to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP. Please tune in next Monday at 10 a.m. for a topic solely devoted to you, the federal employee. The show can also be heard 24/7 on federalnewsradio.com. Thanks for listening.